This is audiobook of The Life Beyond the Veil, Volume 4, named The Battalions of Heaven, by Vaila in original from April 1921. This volume was printed in 1921, 1928, June 1947 and June 1959. It was also printed in the USA. This Kindle ebook version was created by Jeff Cutler in March 2015 and no copyright is claimed in this publication. This edition contains the preface from both the first 1921 edition and the revised 1946 edition, as I found that there is slightly different information contained in each of the first four original volumes. Foreword, 1946. The Greater World Association have undertaken to reprint the four volumes comprising the illuminating scripts received through the mediumship of the Reverend G. Vaila Owen. It has been a great loss to the movement that these books have been out of print for so long, for it is generally agreed that no other communications from spirit realms have had such a wide appeal to the world at large. This is due partly, we know, to the extensive publicity given to them by that great newspaper proprietor, Lord Northcliffe, who, ignoring general prejudice and cynicism regarding the possibility of such communications, published them serially in the Weekly Dispatch in 1920-21, and spent a great deal of money in announcing their appearance. It is natural to ask, how were these spirit messages received? The answer is given by Vaila Owen himself in the first book of the series, The Lowlands of Heaven. Then comes the next question, what was this clergyman like? Those who did not meet Vaila Owen might well picture a dreamer, a man separated from the usual things of daily life, a saint or an ascetic. But although all who knew Vaila Owen personally had no doubt about his spirituality, they would not agree that he was a man who lived in the clouds, rather he was one who needed human love and the gladness of physical life. We are very grateful, therefore, to the Reverend G. Eustace Owen for giving us a few details about his father, which shows that he was a practical man with a sense of humor and a great tolerance for the weakness of others, which means that he was a very good companion as well as a good Christian. The Reverend Eustace Owen writes, in his book With Northcliffe in Fleet Street, J. A. Hamilton alludes to the Reverend Vaila Owen as that typical visionary of a half-Christian, half-spiritualist sort. That view is held by many people who knew him through his writings, but it is not a true portrait. My father was a visionary without being a crank. While having a clear view of life's spiritual basis, he was most practical and methodical in all his ways. I remember how gently he dealt with others, how broad-minded he was in argument, his tolerance of opponents, and how he endured persecution with immense patience. Many an opponent's sword was blunted by his understanding of the one who wielded it, yet he could be severe when necessary. Cruelty in any form roused his indignation. To bullies and schemers he became a very Elijah. I have never known anyone more direct in thought and words, or one who so detested shams. Beneath his graciousness lay the hardness of a good soldier of the cross, so that he bore scorn and persecution without wavering. Quietness sometimes conceals a rare courage. In the book He Laughed in Fleet Street, Bernard Falk describes a meeting between Lord Northcliffe and my father, in the Times office, when the former asked him to accept £1,000 for publishing extracts from the script in the Weekly Dispatch. He continues, Vaila Owen shook his head. For this part of his writings, he said, he could not take any money. He had been well paid by the publicity given him, and by being able to carry out the sacred duty or placing his revelations before the world. Knowing well Vaila Owen's poverty, I was genuinely sorry to hear him refuse payment, but he was not to be dissuaded. The Reverend G. Eustace Owen adds, all our family are pleased that the script is not to be allowed to remain in oblivion. The rising generation particularly need the comfort and illumination of its message. We are also glad that the greater world have so keenly and so boldly taken up this republication. May their confidence be justified and their labors blessed. The first volume, The Lowlands of Heaven, reprinted in September 1945, was quickly sold out. Now that all four volumes have been printed, a fresh edition of the first book will be published as soon as circumstances permit, and we hope fresh supplies of The Lowlands of Heaven, will be on sale in 3 or 4 months' time. June 1947. This appears to have occurred in July 1949. I preface, 1921. The messages recorded in this volume were all received and written down by the Reverend G. Vale Owen in the vestry of All Hallows, Orford, Lancashire, after Evensong. These 34 communications were first published in the Weekly Dispatch, and their termination on Sunday, September 26, 1920, brought to a conclusion an uninterrupted series which started in that journal on February 1, 1920. The first messages of this series commenced on September 23, 1913, and were from the vicar's mother and Astral. They were followed by others at intervals, the communicators being Zabdiel and Leader and his band. These communications are contained in the first three volumes of this series, and in which I have given full details of how Mr. Vale Owen received the messages, together with data concerning the communicators, their methods, and matters relating to the personality of the one who received and recorded them. This present volume contains the communications from one who gave the name of Arnold, for such was the name, disclosed to Mr. Vale Owen in the message dated February 5, 1918. In the spring of 1921, and on an occasion when Mr. Vale Owen gave his first personal and public statement on the script, he was asked the question as to how he was sure that the messages were not from his own mind, but from some source beyond it. As this question may arise in the minds of many who read these scripts for the first time, I think it will be helpful to give the vicar's answer as recorded at the time in the journal Light. He said it was a straight question, and deserved a straight answer. That was one of the things he knew. He was thinking of the great number of letters he had received, putting that question in various ways. It had been put to him many times, sometimes cynically, but now and then in a very different spirit. He did not think that many of those who asked it realized one simple fact, that there was no one in the whole world whom the answer could affect so deeply as himself. He could assure his hearers that before consenting to make the messages public, he had proved up to the hilt that they did not emanate from his own mind. He said to himself, "I believe in a future life. My father, mother, and little child have passed into that life, and I am going there. It can only be a few years before I join them. Now, G. V. Oh, suppose you go over there and your mother says, 'I am so glad to have you here.' But with regard to those messages, they did not come from us. That would be hell to him, a hell that he could not face. The messages came from his mother and those on the other side. He made himself quite sure of it in more ways than one. He was certain, first of all, that they could not have come from his own subconscious mind, or if they did, they must have been put there. He wrote them at the rate of 24 words a minute on an average. That was not a quick speed if one knew what one was writing about. But he made it a rule not to think of the sittings beforehand. The people who came through were quite unknown to him, except his mother. When he had written, say, on Monday, on Tuesday he put the question, 'Is the writing correct?' More than once he had put the question, and had been stopped. Once his mother had communicated by the planchette, operated by his wife, in terrible trouble. He asked what was the matter, and she said, 'I am in great distress. You have done nothing, but the writing, that is the matter. For the last fortnight it has not come from us. Do not tear it up. It has been given for some purpose. It is not bad, but it is not from us. Wait a fortnight.' Later on she said, 'The way is clear now.' In reply to a further question as to whether he saw any of the beautiful scenes described in the messages, he replied that he did in a way, but not externally. When a city was described, he could see it in his mind's eye. If he were an artist, he could paint the scenes except for some of the details. He asked his mother, when she was communicating, how he could know that it was not his imagination. She said, 'My dear boy, it is your imagination. What else can it be? We have trained you for many years, before you knew, so that we can use not only your hand but the whole of you, including your imagination, and by that imagination we have built up the images that you see.' Again being asked to describe his sensations when writing, Mr. Vale Owen said that was difficult for him to do. Many of his hearers who had read the script would know that they went right from regions of light to those of darkness. Angels could not always come right down to him, and he had to lift himself to them. That had at times been a great effort, especially when the messages were ethical and philosophical. He felt as if he was scarcely on earth. When the hells were described, he felt that he had been through them, and he could now understand the look on Dante's face. From the above we gain a little insight into the verity of these messages and the source of their origin, but much depends on the reader himself. There is no scientific proof possible to offer in matters such as is dealt with in the Valerian script. Their true value can only be gauged by spiritual standards and such appeal as they may make to an interior sense of reality. To those who have this vision, the glorious vista of the life to come, as described in these communications, will have a meaning too deep for words. In the ascending grandeur of these messages there is revelation that will bring the reality of the divine love and the glory of the eternal Christ vividly into the hearts of all those who are ready and willing to receive it. H. W. Inham, London, June, 1921. The one who communicated the messages contained in this volume gave the name of Arnall. The vicar first heard of Arnall when receiving messages from his mother in October, 1913. In answer to a question from Mr. Valerian as to why his mother, who was describing one of the heavenly estates to which she had been sent on a mission, did not give the name of the ruler of the estate, she wrote the following through the vicar's hand. His name was Arnall, but these names sound so strange to earth ears, and people are always trying to find out their meaning, that we are rather shy of giving them. This passage is to be found in Volume I of this series, The Lowlands of Heaven. It will be noted Mrs. Valerian spelt the name with an O. Over 4 years later, on February 5, 1918, and when receiving the messages contained in this volume, Mr. Valerian asked the communicator, whom he had up to then addressed by the general term leader or leader of the band of communicators, see Volume 3, The Ministry of Heaven, to tell him his name. It was given as Arnall. The vicar then asked Arnall if he was the one referred to as far back as October, 1913, and the answer was, I am he of whom your mother told you. Write it with one or other letter as you will, it shall suffice that you know me by that name hereafter. Then again, in the message received on the evening of the 4th day of March, 1918, see Chapter 3, Arnall revealed a little of his earth life and the period of the world's history when he lived here. Again, at the end of the sitting in the vestry on March 8, see Chapter 3, Mr. Valerian questioned Kathleen, Arnall's spirit assistant, and from this and the previous communication we glean that Arnall was an Englishman who, in consequence of religious persecution, had to flee to Florence, and lived there in the English colony during the early days of the Renaissance. He taught music and painting, and died, as he said, in midlife, escaping thereby the further enmity of the church and the state of those days. Through Mr. Valerian's hand the name Arnall was written at the conclusion of each communication from him and the sign of the cross affixed below it. Regarding Arnall's spiritual status at the time he was communicating the messages in this volume, it is recorded in the first message, dated February 5, that he was then a temple dweller on the borders of spheres 10 and 11, see Chapter 1, thus indicating that Arnall is a being of a high spiritual order. 1. Zabdiel, referred to in Chapter 1, is the one who communicated the messages through Mr. Valerian, all of which are contained in Volume 3 of this series entitled The Highlands of Heaven. Zabdiel has given no indication as to who he may have been during his earth life, but his spiritual presence has been very real to the Vicar of Orford, and reasons for this have been given at some length in Volume 2 in the General Notes. Kathleen, who is referred to in Chapter 2 and Chapter 3, acted as intermediary between Mr. Valerian and Arnall. In earth life she was a seamstress who lived in Liverpool, and passed over at the age of 28 in the year 1893. In Chapter 3 of Volume 3, The Ministry of Heaven, the importance of Kathleen respecting these messages is clearly defined by Leader and his band. Mr. Valerian's mother, to whom reference is made in Chapter 1, died in the year 1904, and communicated the first messages the vicar received during September and October, 1913. all of which are contained in Volume 1 of The Life Beyond the Veil entitled The Lowlands of Heaven. 1. I would not judge a spirit resident in the 10th sphere as being of high order, but I would agree it is certainly of sufficient order for these communications. My personal preference would be that the spirit be a Christ spirit or one who has passed beyond the 14th sphere 7 in the other counting system. GJC, how the messages came. There is an opinion abroad that the clergy are very credulous beings. But our training in the exercise of the critical faculty places us among the most hard to convince when any new truth is in question. It took a quarter of a century to convince me 10 years that spirit communication was a fact, and 15 that the fact was legitimate and good. From the moment I had taken this decision, the answer began to appear. First, my wife developed the power of automatic writing. Then through her I received requests that I would sit quietly, pencil in hand, and take down any thoughts which seemed to come into my mind projected there by some external personality and not consequent on the exercise of my own mentality. Reluctance lasted a long time, but at last I felt that friends were at hand who wished very earnestly to speak with me. They did not overrule or compel my will in any way that would have settled the matter at once, so far as I was concerned, but their wishes were made ever more plain. I felt at last that I ought to give them an opportunity, for I was impressed with the feeling that the influence was a good one, so, at last, very doubtfully, I decided to sit in my cassock in the vestry after evensong. The first 4 or 5 messages wandered aimlessly from one subject to another, but gradually the sentences began to take consecutive form, and at last I got some which were understandable. From that time, development kept pace with practice. The reader will find the result in the pages following. G. Valoin. Autumn, 1925. Introduction. By Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. The long battle is nearly won. The future may be checkered. It may hold many a setback and many a disappointment, but the end is sure. It has always seemed certain to those who were in touch with truth, that if any inspired document of the new revelation could get really into the hands of the mass of the public, it would be sure by its innate beauty and reasonableness to sweep away every doubt and every prejudice. Now worldwide publicity is being given to the very one of all others which one would have selected, the purest, the highest, the most complete, the most exalted in its source. Verily the hand of the Lord is here. The narrative is before you and ready to speak for itself. Do not judge it merely by the opening, lofty as that may be, but mark the ever-ascending beauty of the narrative, rising steadily until it reaches a level of sustained grandeur. Do not carp about minute details, but judge it by the general impression. Do not be unduly humorous because it is new and strange. Remember that there is no narrative upon earth, not even the most sacred of all, which could not be turned to ridicule by the extraction of passages from their context and by over-accentuation of what is immaterial. The total effect upon your mind and soul is the only standard by which to judge the sweep and power of this revelation. Why should God have sealed up the founts of inspiration 2,000 years ago? What warrant have we anywhere for so unnatural a belief? Is it not infinitely more reasonable that a living God should continue to show living force, and that fresh help and knowledge should be poured out from him to meet the evolution and increased power of comprehension of a more receptive human nature, now purified by suffering? All these marvels and wonders, these preternatural happenings during the last 70 years, so obvious and notorious that only shut eyes have failed to see them, are trivial in themselves, but are the signals which have called our material minds to attention, and have directed them towards those messages of which this particular script may be said to be the most complete example. There are many others, varying in detail according to the sphere described or the opacity of the transmitter, for each tinges the light to greater or less extent as it passes through. Only with pure spirit will absolutely pure teaching be received, and yet this story of heaven must, one would think, be as near to it as mortal conditions allow. And is it subversive of old beliefs? 1,000 times no. It broadens them, it defines them, it beautifies them. It fills in the empty voids which have bewildered us. but save to narrow pedants of the exact word who have lost touch with the spirit, it is infinitely reassuring and illuminating. How many fleeting phrases of the old scriptures now take visible shape and meaning! Do we not begin to understand that house with many mansions, and realize Paul's house not made with hands, even as we catch some fleeting glance of that glory which the mind of man has not conceived, neither has his tongue spoken? It all ceases to be a far-off elusive vision and it becomes real, solid, assured, a bright light ahead as we sail the dark waters of time, adding a deeper joy to our hours of gladness and wiping away the tear of sorrow by assuring us that if we are only true to God's law and our own higher instincts, there are no words to express the happiness which awaits us. Those who mistake words for things will say that Mr. Valoan got all this from his subconscious self. Can they then explain why so many others have had the same experience, if in a less exalted degree? ? I have myself epitomized in two small volumes the general account of the other world, drawn from a great number of sources. It was done as independently of Mr. Valoan as his account was independent of mine. Neither had possible access to the other. And yet as I read this far grander and more detailed conception, I do not find one single point of importance in which I have erred. How, then, is this agreement possible if the general scheme is not resting upon inspired truth? The world needs some stronger driving force. It has been running on old inspiration as a train runs when the engine is removed. New impulse is needed. If religion had been a real compelling thing, then it would show itself in the greatest affairs of all the affairs of nations, and the late war would have been impossible. What church is there which came well out of that supreme test? Is it not manifest that the things of the spirit need to be restated and to be recoupled with the things of life? A new era is beginning. Those who have worked for it may be excused if they feel some sense of reverent satisfaction, as they see the truths for which they labored and testified gaining wider attention from the world. It is not an occasion for self-assertion, for every man and woman who has been honored by being allowed to work in such a cause is well aware that he or she is but an agent in the hands of unseen but very real, wise, and dominating forces. And yet one would not be human if one were not relieved when one sees fresh sources of strength, and realizes the all-precious ship is held more firmly than ever upon her course. Signature shown. Into the Light. Chapter 1. The Temple of the Holy Mount. Tuesday, February 5, 1918. You would like us to give you some account of the origin and aspect of the Temple of the Holy Mount. It stands between the spheres 10 and 11. And when we say that, we mean that it is visible from both of those spheres, and yet is wholly encompassed by neither one nor other. One, its origin came about this way. Ages ago there were many who passed from the one sphere into the other who were qualified by training. But sphere 10 is, in a manner, a sphere wherein are rounded off and ordered all those attributes of power and character which have been gathered in their journey by those who have passed through the spheres below. Here ends one grand stage of their journey, and the next stage is one wherein advance is made of a somewhat different order of evolution and development than previously. Previously the duties performed by those spirits in their advance have been, on the whole, of protective and strengthening quality. Guardian angels you would call them, maybe. This help truly develops and becomes of a more spiritual tone as they rise higher. But essentially it is of the same order, if of a different aspect, in its application to those who are watched and aided, both in the earth sphere, and in all those spheres intervening up to the 10th. But those who enter the sphere 11 now take on another series of duties. Their service now develops into that which is creative. They begin to learn of the great mysteries of the universe of life, not now as to its operative power as is more outwardly obvious, but as to its more inward potency, as it is found nearer to those holy ones who dwell about the Father's home. So do they add the greater to those lesser qualities already assimilated into their personalities, and, becoming attuned by degrees to the sphere ahead, prepare for their advance into that realm where creation opens out to them in all its grand panoply of might and of majestic beauty. This is one of the uses of that temple, and indeed its principal use, and of the others we have no need at this time to speak of. You would like us to try to describe its plan and elevation. We will try to do so. But you should keep in your mind that, as in the present description of its uses, so now in our description of its aspect we speak but imperfectly, for not only stands the temple to crown a sphere not of matter but of spirit substance, but also of spirit atmosphere and environment intensified, by refinement tenfold. What that means in terms of dynamics and of potential forces we do not pause to hazard, for we should fail to make any reasonable explanation for you in your language. This temple was raised for the purpose of blending the two spheres, with their varying aspects of service, together. Here, then, those who are about to leave the one for the other, are brought together and dwell here usually for a lengthy period, going forth, from time to time, into the sphere 10 and those below, on their service as of old to help, or to protect, or to instruct, or to develop those whose home is there. But they also begin to escort those from the spheres above on their missions into sphere 11. At first they do not go far, nor for long. But as they become stronger and more attuned to the finer pulsations of that sphere, so they go farther afield, and stay for longer and longer time. Returning they rest in the temple, and, perhaps, in the interim, they go into one of the spheres below on duties of service there. You have already received a description of one of these missions being sent on a journey through the lower realms and into those lower spheres of gloom. Comment, see Book A Wanderer in the Spirit Lands, of Francesc So, on that theme. That mission of ours, friend, was a very severe test, for it encompassed, in its entirety, not one or two, but the whole gamut of the spheres between Earth and this, and also invaded those farther afield. This very strenuous test of endurance, adaptability in condition and in the attuning of our minds, as well as our bodies, to deal with problems so far removed from our normal condition and temperament of life and service, was given with intention. It was a final test of me who had dwelt within the temple and was ready for advance into Sphere 11, and for those of my good friends who were for me an escort, it was a test also for their advancement from the Sphere 9 into Sphere 10, and of two of them from Sphere 10 to be henceforth dwellers in the temple. Also, you will note a certain significance in the fact that I was required to go and gather that company of people from the utter darkness, too, and bring them towards the light, as a final test of service before my calling into the series of spheres wherein the creative faculty is quickened and trained. I did not understand it then, nor do I even now, yet my enlightening has already begun, and I seem to see a little of the glories ahead for those who once were in so grievous a plight, and now are almost at their ease, and at least are able to know what happiness is to those who go forward on their appointed way. Have you, then, passed from the 10th to the 11th sphere? Not yet permanently. I am still a temple dweller, but more and more I become attuned with the conditions of sphere 11. So many are the items which go to make up the sum of our life here, and yet which are each of much import, that while I hesitate to ignore one of them, yet you have neither time nor material on which to write a thousandth part of them. Here is one. The period of residence in that temple is almost always a very long period. In my case it will be longer than with most. For this reason, I have a charge, I mean the people of Barnabas 3, to watch, to aid, and to conserve in the path of progress onward. I must, from time to time, visit them in person and visibly. I must therefore keep myself in good fettle to condition myself speedily, not to a sphere once or twice removed from my present normal realm, but one far away in the dim ends of space, so to say it. Mine is therefore a double task. I stand here on the tableland, and I must keep one hand extended upward to grip, and the other extended downward to give. Well, well, there you have it, friend, I need not enlarge. You will see my meaning. Zabdiel 4 has passed into Sphere 11, hasn't he? Yes, so far as his service in principle is considered. But yet he also comes to the temple on occasion, and, attuning himself once more to his old estate, passes onward towards Earth on some mission to those lower planes of life. Returning, he will pass through the temple on the way to his proper place of service. And now enough, for this occasion, of condition and environment. Let me tell you of the temple itself. But stop now, you are spent of power. Before I go, leader, I would like you to tell me your name. Leader is the only one I know you by, and it does not commend itself much to me,